Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, squalene, an oil primarily taken from shark liver, being used in the development of some vaccines against COVID-19. Good news for us, but bad news for sharks. Timely advice to drivers from Mayo County Council, telling them to slow down. It's the rutting season for deer. And John Bell O'Reilly takes a tour of our other National Botanic Gardens in Kilmacurra, County Wicklow.
That's right, Derek. It's my first time here at the gardens at Kilmacurra, and what instantly strikes me about this tree lover's paradise about 30 minutes south of Bray are the wonderful commanding views it takes in of the surrounding rolling Wicklow countryside and an almost otherworldly sense of calm and colour on this fine September day.
So, a very busy programme ahead of us today, and a busy studio. In studio we have Niall Hatch. Niall is the Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland. Is that your correct title, Niall?
It's actually, technically, Public Relations Branches and Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland. That's a bit of a mouthful, so just from Birdwatch Ireland will do.
Branches, indeed. You'll be growing leaves next.
Well, the right man beside me here.
Indeed. Dr. Matthew Jebb from the National Botanic Gardens is here, and Matthew, you're in to tell us about what later on today?
I'm going to be telling you about a report that's just come out of the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew in London. And this is an astonishing insight into the extinction of plants around the world.
And Richard Collins is safely cocooned at home in Malahide. Richard.
Hello, Derek. Yes, it's nice to talk to someone for a change.
You've got the wife. Doesn't she talk to you?
Yes, but we're two in one flesh, you know. The wife and myself are one person now. We've become one person.
Are you still sharing the same bath water?
Oh, absolutely. A very good idea. Don't let me get onto that. The bath. Do not take showers. They are terribly wasteful to use the same bath water. It's lovely. It's wonderfully intimate.
It's the same J-cloth for drying yourself. Anyway, to something more serious. As you know, we've been following the plight of mute swans in Blessington Street Basin. And we had some bad news a couple of weeks ago when we learned that one of the six cygnets had died. And I'm afraid it's not such great news today either. Terry Flanagan went along earlier on our behalf. Terry.
Well, I'm down in the Blessington Street Basin again. Listeners will remember that we've been following the story of a family of swans here, a mammy swan who reared six cygnets and did a great job on them until 2 weeks ago. I was here 2 weeks ago with the sad news that one of the cygnets had died. But it looked at the time as if this cygnet had died a natural death. It was found on the island. Well, I've got to say that there has been another death. A second cygnet has died. I don't know what's the cause of it. And I suppose the only way we'd ever find out what the cause was by doing an autopsy. And I've made inquiries here. There was no autopsy done on the first animal, and it appears that there will be no autopsy done on the second one. I'm joined by local man Ben McArdle. Ben, you've taken a great interest in these swans. What does it mean to you seeing a second one die? And have you any idea what might have caused it?
Yeah, it's very disappointing, Terry. I live nearby, so I have been had a great interest in them. I've been popping in on a daily or weekly basis to give them scraps of salad or whatever I might have that would be good for their diet.
Now, can I just cut across you there by saying, where we're actually standing here now, there's a sign right in front of us telling people not to feed the swans with bread.
Yeah, I do think that their diet is quite good. You know, there's a lot of green food, a lot of vegetables, salads. People give them scraps of those type of foods.
Well, I worry a little bit about the structure of the basin here because it's quite deep. And swans normally like to feed in shallow water where they can upturn and put the head in and they can pick off various bits of algae and God knows what that's present on the bottom. They just can't do that here.
Yeah, that's true, Terry. It is a bit too deep for them to graze off any grasses or weeds that might be growing from the bottom, like you might see on the canal. Mm. When you're passing by the canal there, you'd see a swan's bum up in the air.
Stuck up in the air, yeah. But having said that too, I've been here now a number of times, five or six times in the last 3 or 4 months, and they have been doing really, really well.
Yeah, it looked like they were doing really well. Yeah, it's very disappointing.
So you'd wonder, is it food or is it a lack of food? And the worry I would have is, if two of them have died now in a very, very short space of time, within 2 weeks, what's the chances of something happening to the others?
Yeah, I think we'll just have to keep an eye on that and hope for the best at the moment. You know, we can just encourage everyone to feed them the best food that they can, you know, lots of green foods, salads.
I think really that's the key thing from the public, isn't it? Stop feeding bread, and if you're going to feed them with greenery.
Absolutely, yeah. The bread is absolute no-no for them. The rest of them do look like they're doing really well, so we just hope for the best with them.
Thanks very much indeed, Terry. Richard, is bread really the enemy?
Well, I know it's not as simple as that, I don't think. This is a pattern that I have seen over the years that I was doing intensive studies. Now, it occurred in places where no bread was being offered. For instance, Tonlagi Reservoir would have a clutch like that every year, and the babies would die off one by one, you see. And the same was true in Abbeville, Charlie Haughey's place, the similar kind of pattern there some years. Now, one of the interesting places was Mosny Holiday Camp. Now, Mosny, that was before it was a refugee centre. It was a holiday camp, and they had a pair of swans that produced cygnets every year, and the cygnets used to die off. Now, the director then, back then, whose name won't come to me off the top of my head, was very go ahead, and he had an analysis done on those swans at Abbottstown. It was a bit, as it always is with this kind of thing, inconclusive, because you can never... death is a multifactorial thing, even for us. It's not just one thing that kills you, it's a convergence of problems that come together and tip you over the limit and you die. And it was something like that. But there was Echinuria, which is a worm-like organism. There's a galaxy of these creatures. Now, these things live in the gut of the swan, and all swans have them, all wildfowl have these things. They live in equilibrium with these things. An animal is not just a species, it is an ecosystem in many ways, and all kinds of other things live off it, outside it in the feathers, in the case of a bird, inside it in the gut, in the case of everything else. And we used to have fleas and ticks and lice all over us until very recent times. So what we thought happened back then in numerous such cases was that a cygnet hasn't the strength, not getting enough nutrient to be strong enough to overcome the demands of these gut parasites, whereas the adults are. So they are able to keep them in check. So I hate to pontificate about things like that. I don't think bread is all that terrible.
But still, we don't want them to feed bread, and they have signs in the basin encouraging people to feed the swans the right food. And I know that Ed Bowden, who's one of the staff with Dublin City Council, who's based there, his office is in there, was feeding them with frozen peas, which he had defrosted and thrown onto the water so the swans would come along and pick them up. And they seem to be enjoying that.
Yes, I tried all that years ago. I used to give them lettuce and cabbage. But they're like children. They preferred the junk food. There was a big flock in Source. There still is. And you'd come along with chopped up lettuce and carrots and things. And they'd ignore them completely and wait for the next car to come along with loaves of bread and a stale bread, sliced pans. And this is what they really took to. They loved that. And of course, it goes through them in about 20 to 40 minutes. You know, it leaves very little behind. Now, there was some work done on fungi that develop in feathers. There's a disease of feathers, which is carried by bread. But I want you to balance this. Remember, swans are ambassadors for conservation. Mute swans are not threatened. And they are enormously beneficial. People come along with their children or their grandchildren and they feed the swans and it's a big day out and they never quite forget it. And it makes them love the natural world and protect it. I think you have to balance the two forces. You know, it's like drink. It's bad for us, but it does have certain advantages. It's like all kinds of junk food and things. We eat too much, we're too fat. But we have to benefit.
Everything in moderation is the old
saying,
Richard.
Well, in medio virtu. Stat, as Aristotle said, yes. Anyway, that's the way it is. That's my thoughts on the subject. Now, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent, said Wittgenstein. And I think I should be silent here too, because I don't know the answer to the question.
Well, perhaps then an autopsy is called for. Maybe if another one dies, they should send it off.
The world of microfauna, you think the world of macrofauna that we live in is complex, but it is nothing compared to the thousands of nematodes and trematodes and creatures that live down there. As you go down the food chain, things get more and more and more complex. So anyway...
Of course, it's not unusual for cygnets to die. I mean, when it comes to wild birds, the mortality rate for the young is extremely high. You know, we humans, with all of our medicine and so forth, we're not so much used to that in our own lives. But in the natural world, it's a tough place. In a place like Blessington Street Basin as well, it's a difficult environment for cygnets. It's extremely deep. It doesn't have shallow sides. And I could see a situation where, you know, if there's any weakness in a cygnet, its siblings will outcompete it for food. They'll go and get it. They have huge energy and protein requirements when they're growing. So that may be a factor in it. But the fact is that it's a very visible public place. So people are noticing the young cygnets dying. Mm. This happens all over the country. Many cygnets have died in recent weeks.
No, but we don't want to see it happen. We don't want another one to die, do we?
We are too sentimental about wildlife. And I suppose,
and rightly so, Matthew.
Well, yes and no. Like Niall says, you know, natural selection is ferocious and unfeeling. And if every bird survived from a clutch, we would be overrun by blackbirds, robins and swans in the following year. So essentially, a pair of swans have only got to successfully raise to adulthood two swans in their lifetime to replace themselves so that next year we have the same population of swans.
Yes, that's it. In the midst of life, we are in death, as you often hear at funerals. And that is really true. The reason they have such large clutches, on average 6.7 eggs, it's based on the idea that very few of them are going, and that's every year. So, as Matthew says, we want to leave a successor for the mother alive and a successor for the father alive, on average, at the end of the day. That's in Ireland, 5 years on average. And the Blessington Street ones, to my surprise in a way, are doing rather well, because the number of young alive from a clutch at 3 months from this stage is about 3.5 young. So they're doing extremely well, despite the poverty of the area in one sense. It's very confining. There is not great diversity there, but they're doing very well. And the staff have to be complimented on how well they're looking after them.
Anyway, we'll leave that. Thanks very much indeed, Richard and Terry, for going along there to the Blessington Street Basin. And hopefully, those four remaining cygnets will make it to, inverted commas, fledging, to be rushed off the scene next year by the female, and they'll make their own way in life. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on it, and Terry will pop in and out of Blessington Street Basin to keep you informed. Now, squalene, is an oil primarily taken from shark liver. It is being used in the development of some vaccines against COVID-19. Good news, you might say. Well, good news for us. Probably not good news for the sharks, because it's estimated that it would be necessary to kill up to 500,000 sharks in order to meet the vaccination demands of the world's population against coronavirus. Stephanie Brendel is founder of Shark Allies, a California-based conservation group. She says harvesting something from a wild animal is never going to be sustainable, especially if it's a top predator that doesn't reproduce in huge numbers. Stephanie joins us now from her home in sunny California. Hello, Stephanie. How are you today?
I am fine. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us all about squalene, please.
Let me start by saying that we don't want to create this impression that the vaccine industry is going out to hunt down the sharks immediately. Our point in this is that the potential of how the vaccine industry, the demand will have to be met if the squalene is used as an adjuvant in one of the leading vaccines, or more than one of the leading. It will be year after year. It will require a lot of sharks to fill that demand. And we know that that's the new normal. Coronaviruses are here to stay, and we will need these vaccines for many years to come. So we're not just looking at one dose, 1 year. It's something that will repeat and multiply over the years. And, you know, it's not a secured supply chain. It's just not a good idea to base an ingredient of something that needs to be duplicated by the billions on a wild animal.
Now, flu vaccines have been around since I was a child, from what I can remember. Right. So what have they been using up to date? I mean, have they been using squalene prior to this?
Yes, there's many different flu vaccines, but they have been using it in flu vaccines and also in testing for certain coronavirus treatments. Up until now, it never seemed like a really big problem. I do know many people chose not to take those particular vaccines that had shark in them because they're also worried that they, you know, the purity is not the greatest. And, you know, we do know that it's quite likely that endangered species end up in shark oil. There's just no transparency in that industry. But the problem really is more of what could happen going forward, because now we're talking about a global vaccine and most likely it not being 30 different vaccines, but, you know, potentially, I don't know, maybe it will be 10 different ones and maybe only some of them will be adjuvanted. But we're trying to say, why don't we solve a problem before it becomes a really big problem for once? Do we really need to let this go to a point like we did with manta rays where, you know, we wiped the species out for one product, and that does not need to happen. There are alternatives that can be used.
I would have no idea what's in a flu vaccine. I've had the flu vaccine in my 53 years once, to be honest with you.
Yes, me too.
I don't know what's in it. I wouldn't have known there was any such thing as squalene. You were just saying there that some people opt not to take the vaccine if they know. How would they know squalene is in it?
I think one of the great lessons from this, which Stephanie would be very aware of, is how a small action by ourselves, having a vaccination, is impacting upon a wild species. And that interconnectedness of the world, the biological world, is one of the most important stories we can tell here. Because COVID is a big story, here is the opportunity to actually share an incredible connection that we, a vast majority of people, we're totally unaware of.
Is there an alternative?
Yes, and we would not have even come out with a story. We actually have been researching this since February, and we were very aware of the fact that we cannot and we will not come out against the vaccine. We're not saying hold it up or slow it down. We wanted to know for sure that there are alternatives, and squalene gets made from many plant sources, even bacteria, algae, and now companies are also developing synthetically based squalene, which is very easy to, much more safely to be reproduced. And they are existing. The problem is always that is being stated is that it hasn't been tested. So our ask has always been, continue with what you're doing. Yes, we all need to have a COVID vaccine, and if it needs to be sharks, so be it. However, we need to start testing the alternatives, because if we never test them, we'll never be able to switch over.
Obviously, when it comes to plant-based squalene or synthetic squalene, one of the benefits of that, of course, is that it would be vegan. Do you think that veganism would be a concern for people who now know that there are shark products in some of the vaccines they're taking?
Yes, it's actually also something in the cosmetics industry that some people don't know. The labeling is not always transparent on what squalene is being used anywhere, really. Often it's not specified, it just says squalene. So it could be an issue, but more than that, it's really the supply and demand of, you know, even if you don't worry about sharks and the cruelty, is taking something, you know, from the ocean that we depend on is just not a good idea. And also taking something that has to be largely imported and exported and is not a safe supply chain is also pretty silly, because if we can make it domestically, why wouldn't we do that?
And when it comes to the sharks, is it any species of shark that can be harvested for this, or are there certain specific species that have more of this squalene in them?
Yes and yes. I mean, every shark has a liver, so you can use any liver to make oil. And it's also, they hold a lot of liver, and sharks have very large livers, especially the deep sea species, because sharks don't have swim bladders. So they use the oil. The oil in the liver helps them deal with buoyancy and with the pressures of the deep. So some of the very rare deep water shark species are potentially could potentially be targeted because their livers can be 20 or 30% of their body weight. The list of sharks that are targeted for oil is fairly long, and I'm being told many times, I've been asked this week, well, they're being taken for meat anyway. What's your fuss? But I would say 80% of the sharks on this list are not meat sharks. I don't think anyone really eats blue shark. Basking sharks, Greenland shark maybe traditionally is eaten. But there's so many sharks on this list that I doubt anybody has ever eaten their meat. So what are they being targeted for? Potentially for the fin trade, but that surely shouldn't be an excuse. But that's something we have to battle as well.
Richard.
Stephanie, can I be devil's advocate and turn things a bit on their head?
Sure.
The things that are most successful, the creatures that have really dominated the animal world, are the ones that are useful for us. You think of cattle, sheep, pigs and chickens. Mm-hmm. They do extremely well, and they do so because they serve us. We need them, and we protect them as a result. Now, sharks are universally hammered. About 3 million are killed every year, I understand. If we could argue that they are of benefit to us, would that strengthen the hand of conservationists? Could we turn it around and say, we need sharks. They are vital. We can use them to prepare medicines which can save our lives. Is there any strength in that argument at all?
Yes, actually, if we only took them for vital medicines, I would be all for that. Let's not take them for fins and for meat. We'd be saving 70 million sharks and I would be done with my job. Secondly, we are not breeding and growing them in order to harvest them. Now, if we had to take wild cattle and wild chicken, I don't think we would be having any left. They wouldn't be protected. I think what we treasure the most is and what we use the most is what we can grow and then harvest and what we can reproduce. And as you probably know, you cannot raise sharks in captivity and trying to get them to reproduce and trying to feed a top predator long enough to be an adult would be a ridiculous proposal.
Would the name Keem Bay mean anything to you? Keem Bay is a bay in Achill Island in the west of Ireland. Now, in 1951, 1,650 basking sharks were taken. Now, these have enormous livers. And between 1950 and 64, I think it was, 9,000 sharks were killed. Now, this is a kind of an industry. Now, it collapsed, of course. But can you see a systematic, controlled harvesting of sharks in a place like Keem Bay? Or is that an impossibility?
Well, as you said, it collapsed. So if you could do it in a way that assures that the population doesn't collapse, which with a lot of these very slow growing sharks would mean you would only be able to take so very few that it practically isn't an industry, then, you know, if you can figure that out, I think this is where we come back to the more tribal use of animals where they were taken, you know, one or two a year. That's different from taking industrial level animals. I think it's very difficult to hunt any animal and, you know, in an industry unless it is farmed. You know, even with deer and other animals, you know, very often they're being farmed and re-released. I don't know of many wild populations of animals that have been hunted successfully commercially and have been able to sustain that unless their predators have already been taken out.
There is an alternative that might be of interest. Gualus is Latin for sea fish. The dogfish group, for instance, Squalus is a genus in that group. Now, among the creatures which produce lots of squalene are petrels. Fulmar petrels nest all along the coast of Ireland. Now, I have ringed them, not recently, because I'm far too old not to be climbing up sea cliffs and things, but when you go close
to them...
Never
give up, Richard, never give up.
Well, I won't give up yet, no, but they fire this filthy liquid at you. That's their defence, because they can't stand. Now, they will do this any time you get close to the nest. So would it be possible to collect this stomach fluid, effectively, from things like fulmars and petrels, without harming them? We could milk them like cows. And we could, in fact, develop a squalene source using that. Have you ever heard of such a weird notion? Is it off the wall? Should I be locked up?
You would have to talk to bird people about this. I don't know enough about it, but I just feel that, yes, there's lots of strange ways to go about this, but plants... Come on. I mean, nothing's easier than reproducing plants or bacteria. You can make grow them in the lab. I think for the reproducing anything, and if you can have full control of how to grow it and how to make it, I think that seems to be, to me, the easiest solution. And then we don't have to milk birds or cut livers out of sharks or do whatever crazy things we might have. I've had some very interesting proposals. Somebody emailed me saying that women also make some substance in their vagina, and why don't we have women donate that to make squalene? So there you go.
I think on that point, Stephanie,
well, actually,
one point, which is the plant sources.
Can I just say before you go on, Matthew, that Stephanie, you said we need to talk to a bird person or a plant person. Well, as it happens, the voice you're about to hear now is Dr. Matthew Jebb, who's director of the National Botanic Gardens in Ireland. And we also have Niall Hatch, who happens to be from the largest NGO in the country, Birdwatch Ireland, the Conservation Society looking out for birds in Ireland. So, Matthew.
Olive trees. Olive oil is a very rich source of squalene, and
yes,
I think there would be tremendous benefit in people saying, well, I'm going to buy olive oil that's had the squalene extracted, because it's quite easy to fractionate oils, and there would be a great benefit in two directions. Save sharks by eating squalene extracted olive oil. These are beneficial things, because what it always comes down to, the cynical truth of all of this, is how cheap something is, and catching sharks out in the ocean, where you have to put no work other than just getting hold of this fish and then just taking the part you need, it's free. And that is the reason squalene comes from sharks, is because it's the cheapest source. And we need to realise the value of the world around us. And it should not come down to a financial price. It should come down to our own futures.
Yeah, because the price that is charged from all of us, you know, all of us, I mean, the ocean sort of belongs to no one and all of us. It's not just the fishermen's domain and or any kind of corporations that get products out of them. So, yes, if I am a vaccine producer, my bottom line is only what I have to pay. But nobody ever really calculates the true expense, which is the expense that we pay when we have to fix other problems in the ocean. So that's, you know, and that's not accounted. Plus, I mean, it is the pharmaceutical industry, and I don't think that they're hurting from money. I believe that, you know, whoever comes up with a vaccine for COVID and other coronaviruses, it stands to make billions off this. That, you know, I know that they want to help humanity, but I also believe it's probably very good business. So going the extra mile to help mass production of an alternative and testing it additionally to what they already have, I don't think is an unreasonable ask.
Just before Niall comes in and addresses Richard's point about the fulmars being a bird person, have you been in touch with any of the large pharmaceutical companies and made these points to them?
We tried. We actually reached out to them to find out exactly what they use, where they get it from, what is the reason they prefer to use it. Because for months we were really trying to research whether sharks contribute something magical to their squalene that we can't argue. You know, I said, you know, if sharks somehow have something very special about them in their squalene that's different from plants, then we can't really ask, you know, to replace it. I wanted to be sure. And pharmaceutical companies generally either didn't answer, brushed us off, or told us it was proprietary information. They wouldn't give us that information. So we talked to chemists and people that knew about squalene, and they said that the compound squalene is exactly the same whether it comes from an animal or from plants because of how it is extracted and whatever it is boiled down into. So we went with that, and we also decided that we needed help from journalists to make these inquiries, because when you have the Daily Telegraph calling up, they will answer. But when you have a little NGO calling, they don't see any reason to give us that information.
Well, you're raising awareness of it now nationally in Ireland. So, Niall.
When it comes to the bird angle, Richard was talking there about fulmars and petrels, so members of the tube nose group of seabirds that includes shearwaters and albatrosses. It would be interesting to see if there was ever a way to, you know, sustainably harvest those from wild birds, because obviously that would be done in a non-lethal way. Having said that, a lot of those species themselves are finding themselves in dire risk of extinction at the moment. The vast majority of the world's albatross species, for example, are critically endangered. And part of that is because of the amount of plastics in the oceans. We've discussed that on the programme many times before. You would also wonder if this could perhaps even contaminate this squalene. We spoke to an expert recently about how some of these chemicals and plastics leach into the stomach oils from these birds. So I'm just wondering if we're contaminating the supply chain there already. I think that, you know, it does certainly point to the fact that perhaps wild birds could be, you know, used in a much more sustainable way and could be a great benefit to us in the same way that eider feathers are. Now, that's one of the most perfect examples of sustainable harvesting of a natural material to make eiderdown. The birds aren't harmed, they're protected.
Mind you, not everybody on the planet is looking for an eiderdown quilt.
Well, that's true. That's true, and it commands a high price, and obviously with a vaccine that would be much more useful. But I think that unfortunately for birds like fulmars, they're on a downward trend. Global warming has changed the distribution of plankton in the oceans. Their food supplies are dwindling. A lot of these birds are in trouble, and we really need to save them. This perhaps is another reason why.
Well, I was in my mind in a fantasy. I saw myself with a long pole, at the end of which we would put some kind of a poppet, and we would lower the pole down towards the ledge where the fulmar is. And there are countless fulmars in places like Clare Island, for instance, abounds in fulmars. Now, you could lower this down and the fulmar will fire this stomach oil straight at this thing, and it could be trapped and taken to the surface. You could do this every few days. He regenerates the oil. It's his defense. It doesn't harm him. It gives him some exercise, in a sense. Maybe this system would work. I don't know.
Stephanie, can I just ask you a quick question? It's well known that President Trump has a very strong aversion to sharks. Has that impacted in any way on your work? Has it made it harder or easier for you?
Oh, gosh, that's a new question. Well, no, not really. I don't think anyone takes that seriously. We joke about it a lot. And it's the policies of having conservatives in charge, and having sort of that on a state level can make things more difficult. But actually, we were able to pass a shark fin trade ban in Florida just this year. And that is an ultra conservative state full of Republicans. And we work bipartisan on a lot of these issues because sharks don't belong to Democrats or Republicans, and they don't belong to Trump or anyone. So as long as people see the economic benefit of protecting sharks and protecting ecotourism, anyone likes money. It doesn't really play into it. It's more of a funny side note.
Well, Stephanie, thank you very much indeed for highlighting the plight of sharks generally, and also for drawing your attention to this, I would say, heretofore little known fact that squalene, which comes from shark liver, is used in the production of vaccines around the world and is going to be used in the production of some of the vaccines against COVID-19. Stephanie, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And can I just say that, for more information, come to our website. Shark Allies is easy to find on all social media. And we also have a petition on change.org. So if you want to voice your opinion, we're easy to find.
And we'll put those details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, Matthew Jebb, talk to me about the state of the world's plants.
Well, this is a very detailed investigation on how threatened are plants around the world. One of the interesting things is we still don't know how many species of plant there are in the world. Every year, we're adding 2,000 new species, but only 10% of the entire world's flora of flowering plants, which is 350,000 species of plant, only 10% of that do we have an accurate idea of how severely threatened they are. Up in the botanic gardens, we have some species of plant that are already extinct in the wild, but we're growing them in captivity. In fact, we have one species in our palm house, and he is the sole remaining individual of his species. Now, he's been replicated around the world because plants can be propagated in an extraordinary way, but he's only a male. There is no female left of that species of cycad. So plants are threatened, and yet every day we are using them. Tables, buildings are made of wood. Breakfast, most of the food we're eating comes from a plant that has grown somewhere. And there are only so many species of edible plant on this planet. And their wild relatives are threatened with extinction. Plants that we don't even have a scientific name for yet, are probably going extinct. So what this investigation was looking at is, well, if we only have investigated 10% of the world's flora, how do we know how many are at risk of extinction. And actually, they've used the mathematics involved in political surveys, because people who respond to a survey are a particular sort of cohort of the population only. So you have to extrapolate. What does this mean for the entire population?
Well, we better say who they are, which is the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew.
The Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew are the ones who have undertaken this investigation. So using an enormous database of knowledge of plants and some very clever mathematics, they worked out that a surprising number of plants are at risk of extinction. And that is 40% of the plants on this planet run the risk of extinction within the next 50 years. And that is a phenomenal figure. Prior to this, we thought, well, maybe 10 or 12% of the world's flora is threatened. But the evidence that they have produced in this paper is very, very shocking. And it's the first time, I suppose, that we have looked at it carefully. Now, one of the problems, I suppose, when one looks at a thing like this, an issue like this, is we only know of 600 species of plant that have gone extinct around the world. But we do know that some species of plant are represented in the wild by half a dozen individuals, and a huge number only represented by 50. I suppose the absolute sort of poster child for this is Hawaii. Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific, 100 species of plant have gone extinct. And we know from historic evidence that these plants are not to be found anywhere in Hawaii. 200 species of plant on Hawaii are only known by less than 50 individuals. So of the total flora of about 1,200, 300 are either extinct already or about to go extinct. So this is a very sobering fact. And something like Hawaii, like an island, tells us a great deal about what is going to happen in the future. Because if I went to the Brazilian rainforest and I cut down a patch of forest...
Well, you better go quick.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Before they burn it down completely.
Well, you know, once you've cut down a huge quantity of forest, that you might left 1 square kilometre and you've chopped down 9. Well, all the species of plant and animal are probably still left in that 1 kilometre, but their population level is now microscopic. It's 1/10 of what it should be. And for some species of bird, especially big raptors, predators, they won't have enough territory to feed on their prey anymore. So they will go extinct. So there's a lag time. So we might commit the atrocities that we have to the biological world. We have exterminated almost 50% of the standing crop of biodiversity on Earth. Populations are very, very low. And during this lag phase, things reach a new equilibrium, which unfortunately is extinction for a lot of species.
Well, in the case of the Brazilian rainforest, we can see why animals and plants would become extinct, because they're being destroyed. But what about other plants? Like you mentioned Hawaii. What's happening on Hawaii that's wiping out all these plant species?
Very similar things. Natural vegetation is being converted to agricultural crops. So they're growing pineapples, they're growing bananas to feed back into the American mainland. But there's also a lot of alien invasive. These are species of... There were no amphibians or reptiles on Hawaii until human beings got involved. And humans have managed to release snakes, lizards and so on, which are now eating up the native plants and animals. They've introduced birds, they've introduced mongoose, they've introduced all of these predators that find this innocent haven of wildlife, and they're eating their way through it or killing it off. So this is the big problem that we face. We have cleared so much of our landscape for agriculture. We have cleared so much of the forests to get timber, again, because it's free, it's just sitting there, we haven't had to grow it, that plants and animals have been left with no habitat to live in. And when we look at different scales, if we go to Clare Island, we've already mentioned it, we mention it many times because we know more about Clare Island than any other part of Ireland. And it's very useful because that knowledge goes back 100 years. And we can see that in the past 100 years, 40 species of plant have gone extinct on Clare Island. In Ireland as a whole, only about a dozen species of plant have gone extinct. But this means that on Clare Island, 10% of the flora has disappeared in the last 100 years. But in Ireland as a whole, only about 1.5%. And globally, it's something like 0.06%. It's tiny as yet. But an island like Clare Island reacts quicker, that within a century of changing the vegetation so much, plants are going extinct. And there is a lag phase. We have now got in Ireland about 40 species of plant that are represented probably by less than 100 individuals.
You would think it would be the other way around. I mean, there's very few people living on Clare Island. It's not industrialised in the way the, I hate to use the term, the mainland is, but it's not. That's just
there are
the reality.
A lot of sheep. There are a lot of sheep tucking into things. So they just, you know, the landscape has changed. It's altered irrevocably. And that's due to EU grants, agricultural systems to encourage, subsidise, you know, increased grazing of hills that people will say, well, they're worthless for agriculture. But, you know, if somebody's going to pay us a headage price for animals, we will put animals on it.
Niall.
Matthew, one of the issues I know in Hawaii and probably elsewhere in the world is the death of pollinating insects and birds and bats. Do you think that's a very significant part of the reason that these plants are in danger?
One of the most significant things for a plant is if your pollinator or the disperser of your seeds has gone extinct, well, you have reached a dead end. And on Hawaii in particular, there's this incredible group of climbing plants we call Freycinetia. They have beautiful three rows of leaves and they climb up trees with big orange-red flowers at the top. And those were always pollinated by honeycreepers. A lot of those are extinct and they've gone into the museums in Honolulu and they have recovered the pollen off the skins of these birds, off their feathers. Mm. And so they've identified all of these extinct pollinators of plants that are no longer being pollinated correctly. So they're sort of doomed to extinction in turn. Everything is sort of intricately connected with one another, and sometimes it only becomes apparent what has gone wrong far too late to put it right.
I often think of islands like Hawaii or closer to home, the Canary Islands. They're almost like miniature continents in the way that they have their own weather systems, their own totally different biodiversity on them. And I see them almost as like laboratory for what will happen to the rest of the world. We're seeing basically the world on a smaller scale, miniaturized and perhaps time sped up. Do you think that's what we're seeing here?
That's exactly what we're seeing. It's so, you know, Clare Island is the canary in our coal mine. That's telling us that if we just sit back now, the same agricultural practices that we are conducting over the whole island of Ireland will lead to a 10% extinction of our flora.
Richard.
Matthew, it's rather daunting what you have said, the sheer magnitude of the problem. Now, this Q report, which is receiving a lot of attention, there were 240-odd contributors, and I suspect you must have been one of them. Now, in the Irish context, taking Ireland as a microcosm of the world, what is the scene here? You mentioned extinction of a limited number of plants here. Now, we have the Lusitanian flora in this case. Yeah. Now, can you? You have actually got a plant zoo. The Botanic Gardens is, in a sense, a plant zoo. Now, in the world of animals, there is a category called extinct in the wild and then extinct totally. But yes. In other words, have you plants there that are extinct in the wild? Irish plants, is this a sustainable way? Can you bring in and can you recreate in North Dublin satisfactory conditions for the threatened plants of Ireland? Or are there many that you can't do that with?
No, we can do that. And that is one of the skills that we have at the garden is 200 years worth of horticultural knowledge, techniques and skills. But of course, historically, you know, gardeners have tended to grow exotic plants from around the world, growing plants that many people would consider as weeds and just wildflowers. That knowledge is something we have built up over the years. So right now, in our collections, we have got some of the most severely threatened plants in Ireland. We have a particular sedge from County Cork. Perhaps there are two plants left in the wild, perhaps three. Perhaps there are none this year. But we have got in the Botanic Gardens three individuals. We have got seeds that are germinating of it. So, yes, in that sense, we have saved it. We have another sedge actually from the shores of Loch Ness. And that went extinct at the end of the 19th century, 1890s, the last wild plant was seen. We still have it in abundance in the Botanic Gardens. So you can keep these things. And one of, I suppose, the extraordinary facts about plant life is that we can clone them, we can freeze their seeds. They are much, much easier to keep. If you were going to try and keep alive great orchids, you would have had to have a big population, you'd have had to look after them, a lot of veterinary care. And even then, they might have decided, no, we're not breeding because we haven't got quite the right feeling about this nesting in captivity. So, you know, animal life is actually extremely difficult to preserve into the future. Whereas plants, we have the advantage of even putting seeds into a deep freeze, and we can freeze seeds sometimes for hundreds of years and recover that plant. Now, there may be no habitat to put it back into. It may not have a pollinator in the future. But these are the sort of problems, I suppose, that we would face trying to get these things back onto their feet in the wild.
Matthew, I'm here for one reason and one reason only, is to always ask, so what can we do?
I suppose the frightening thing about beating the drum of how terrible everything is how can we reduce our personal footprints on this globe? And I think this is the only way. If you switch off a light every time you leave a room, if you say, well, I'm going to keep these shoes a little bit longer, I'm going to consume less, I'm going to try and say, right, is this journey necessary? Am I going to burn those fossil fuels or am I not going to do it? So it is personal self-restraint is the only way that this Earth can be preserved. Every one of us can make a difference just by having a smaller impact, treading more softly on this globe.
Thank you very much indeed, Matthew. Now, you might be one of many people who have enjoyed a pleasant stroll through the National Botanic Gardens of Ireland at Glasnevin in Dublin in recent months, a welcome oasis of calm, it's fair to say, in these challenging times. And entry is, of course, Matthew, Jeff?
Free as ever.
Free as ever.
A great spot to relax and enjoy life.
But I wonder if you would be aware of our other National Botanic Gardens. I'm talking about Kilmacurra and County Wicklow, where the milder climate, higher rainfall and deeper acidic soil support a marked contrast to the plants at Glasnevin. The gardens were developed extensively during the 19th century by Thomas Acton at a time of great botanical exploration, the legacy of which includes some of the world's rarest species and internationally noted conifer and rhododendron collections. John Bell O'Reilly, our researcher, went to Kilmacurra to avail of their free daily guided tours.
That's right, Derek. It's my first time here at the gardens at Kilmacurra, and what instantly strikes me about this tree lover's paradise about 30 minutes south of Bray are the wonderful commanding views it takes in of the surrounding rolling Wicklow countryside and an almost otherworldly sense of calm and colour on this fine September day. My tour guide is Angela Quinn. Angela, the story of Kilmacurra stretches back to early Christian times.
Yeah, that's right, John. Back in the 6th century, there was a man called MacCurrogh. He was a Briton of royal birth, and we know he founded a monastery here. Then Henry VIII caused the dissolution of the monasteries, and everything was quiet until the 1640s, when you had Oliver Cromwell coming to Ireland. One of his officers was a man called Thomas Acton, and he received lands here, about 1,500 acres. The establishment of the gardens would have been from that time. Then in the 1850s, there was a man called Thomas Acton who inherited the estate, along with his sister Janet, and they're the ones who brought in the rare trees to Kilmacurra. In a lot of cases, the trees were given to them by the Moors in Glasnevin, who were two curators, father and son, and they sent down things that they knew would thrive in Kilmacurra. The soil here is particularly good, 5.5 acid soil, and also there's a microclimate, and the microclimate relates to high ground to the southeast, and also the sea is a couple of miles away. So that stops any of the really cold winds from affecting the plants in the wintertime.
Good stuff, Angela. Let's go down and have a look at one of the things that the garden is perhaps best known for, the collection of Himalayan rhododendrons. And to get there, we have to go through this very enchanting Victorian broadwalk. Tell us about the broadwalk.
Okay, so the broadwalk was really created in the 1800s for the fashion at the time, which was the big crinoline dresses. And so therefore, two ladies with the big wide dresses and two gentlemen could fit side by side. And it's enchanting in springtime because of the blossom and because of the colour on the ground. So it's one of these things you have to come and see. Yeah.
And we have here overhead something that looks a bit like a line of very colourful washing, but they are in fact Nepalese prayer flags, which mark the heritage of the plants in this area.
they're celebrating the heritage of the Himalayan rhododendrons. So these are species rhododendrons. They came as seeds back in the 1840s. There was a man called Joseph Dalton Hooker. He was a famous plant hunter. He would have sent the seeds to Kew Gardens. Kew would have sent them to Dublin. And Dublin, because the Moors were in charge, would have sent a lot of them down here. But these are just magnificent trees, which, you know, would normally grow in the Himalaya. And even when they're not in bloom, they're actually quite majestic. So, really love them. Well, the great thing about being a guide out in the open air is that everything is changing all the time. So, you might go away for 2 days. We're going to go straight ahead. You might go away for 2 days, and then when you come back, something that you were, you know, used to seeing is gone, and something completely different is now flowering, you know.
So, just walking past here, Angela, a banana tree.
Yeah, isn't that really amazing? So it's a Japanese banana, and we can see little tiny bananas on it, just above the flower. So it's obviously feeling comfortable here.
Now, I know that we haven't stopped at every stop on the tour, Angela, but here we're approaching the final stop.
Yes.
Tell us about this tree.
Okay, so this is one of our most magnificent trees. It's called the willow-leaved podocarp, Podocarpus salignus, and it's 180 years old. It's also called the shaggy podocarp because of, you know, it has a kind of a, you know, an unkempt look, but it's absolutely beautiful. It has little seeds, and this is the reason it's called the podocarp. Podocarp means foot fruit, and the little seeds are a little red berry with a foot sticking out.
That's great, Angela, and thanks very much for that colourful and intriguing tour of the gardens here at Kilmacurra. Just tell us, when do free daily tours take place, and when do they finish up for the season?
Oh, you're very welcome, John. Tours happen every day at 11, 12, 2 and 3, and our season usually starts the end of March and finishes the end of October. So this year we're finishing on the 21st of October.
And there are some restrictions on tour numbers.
Oh yes, tour numbers are up to six people, and it is possible to book if you want.
And more details can be found on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Now, a county council is asking drivers, very appropriate at this time of year, to look out for love-crazed deer on our roads. This isn't quite as odd as it may appear. However, mating season has started, and so there is an increased likelihood of meeting male deer on our roads as they travel the countryside in search of females. Noel Gibbons is Road Safety Officer at the Communications Department with Mayo County Council, and he joins us now from Castlebar. Hello, Noel. Tell us the story, please.
Hello, and it's not quite as romantic as it sounds, unfortunately. Over the coming weeks, you'll see a significant rise in the number of collisions with deer and motor vehicles. And the reason for that, as you said, is rutting season. So little creatures get killed every day on the roads with butterflies and bees, and they only leave a splatter on your windscreen or a headlight in their passing. But unfortunately, larger animals and deer, they pose a real threat to your vehicle and to your personal being. If you smack into a couple of hundred pounds animal and going at 90 kilometres an hour, it's going to be, both are going to come out and no winner. So what we're trying to do is highlight these dangers. And unfortunately, when deer are moving from their bachelor area, these hormone-fueled stags are crossing roads, and they're not too wise to the road safety rules when crossing roads. So that's where the danger occurs.
And is it a big problem in Mayo?
It's a huge problem, not just Mayo. I suppose the most common types of deer are red deer and fallow deer. And unfortunately, the red deer is a larger deer. So if you hit a red deer, it's going to be higher up when you hit it. So that's going to end up going through your windscreen and cause the death of the deer, and also could be, unfortunately, a fatality for the driver as well. So some local authorities have erected signage along areas where they be traditionally would see deer crossing. So if we're asking motorists to look out for these signs, but it's not possible to put a sign up where every deer is going to be crossing. So if you're this time of year in particular, there will be a high risk that you, and a high possibility that you will meet deer on the move.
And a particular time of day when you're likely to encounter them?
Yes, Derek. The most common times would be early morning, and again in dusk and the evening. Unfortunately, with the deer having a kind of winter coat as well, it makes it more difficult to see. So we're asking people to drive with their lights on, have their full lights on in the mornings when it's dark, but to dim them if they do see the deer, because again, the full lights will actually freeze the deer on the road. And again, if you see one deer, you can bet there's going to be more because they do travel in a herd. So it's very unlikely they will be by themselves.
Well, Noel, thank you very much indeed for the notification. We really do appreciate it. More details, of course, on our website, rte.ie/Marie. That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Niall Hatch, to Dr. Matthew Jebb, to Richard Collins, all of our contributors, our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and our researcher is John Bella Riley. Till next time, goodbye.
Visit the website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.